interrupt our program to bring you a special broadcast. The German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. I repeat, the German news agency Transocean said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun. There was no Allied confirmation.
At this point, we join the facilities of the British Broadcasting Corporation and take you now to London.
So the third machine begins revving up her engines, and bit by bit she's pulling round towards the Tamek. Machines have gone, a 9th, a 10th, 11th, a 12th, and up to something like a score are coming round the aerodrome, one after the other. Each machine with its load of paratroops. One machine with a colleague of mine of the BBC, flying with them and jumping with them. And each machine following the other, showing its green wingtip light as it comes down the perimeter track, and then turns into the wind at the end of the perimeter, past the flares, past the group of senior officers who are standing there watching every machine go. Is full of the noise of these paratroop planes as they circle the aerodrome before they take their course. But just as they're circling in the air, so the others that are waiting to go are circling the track of the aerodrome, their lights moving round in a stately, steady procession. Aboard them are some of the toughest and finest and bravest men that we have in Britain, and they go out today to face their greatest trial. Last aircraft of the first batch taking off to carry British paratroops into the continent of Europe has just left the station. It's gone down over the hill and it's going to follow the procession of others that have gone up into the sky and are turning and wheeling above our heads. Suddenly, for no great reason, except perhaps that the machines have climbed quite far away from us, the noise and the bustle has died down, and we are left on a rather dark, windy, chilly aerodrome in England, watching them go overhead as they shape for their courses, seeing the small groups of staff officers who've helped for months and months in the training of these men and in the preparation of this great plan. And we stand here, alongside the gliders and the other planes that will take off later, realizing that we're present at a very historic occasion. And all around us, for miles and miles, people are going to their beds this night, not knowing that this operation has begun. They will know within 12 hours. Meanwhile, there's only the noise of the departed aircraft to tell us that the attack on Europe has begun.
You have been listening to a recorded dispatch by BBC war correspondent Richard Dimble there.
The Associated Press recorded the broadcast which said the invasion had begun from the west, and that the French port of Le Havre was being shelled. German naval forces off the coast are engaged in a battle with enemy landing craft, the broadcast said. The German news agency said the Allied invasion operations began with the landing of airborne troops in the area of the mouth of the Seine River. I repeat, however, that there is no Allied confirmation of this claim. The National Broadcasting Company will continue its network service throughout the remainder of the night, in view of the important but so far unconfirmed reports from overseas.
This is Robert St. John in the NBC newsroom in New York. Ladies and gentlemen, we may be approaching a fateful hour, and now we have just been informed that we can expect, in a very few seconds, a very important broadcast from the British capital. And so now, we take you to London.
This is Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force. The text of communique number one will be released to the press and radio of the United Nations in 10 seconds. Repeat, 10 seconds from now. Under the command of General Eisenhower, Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France. This ends the reading of communique number one from Supreme Headquarters, Allied Expeditionary Force.
The feints and diversions promised by Winston Churchill and hinted at by the military experts have now been relegated to the limbo of dead words. 250,000 people will say today, this is really it. This is a Queen's move, straight across the board.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
10 seconds, stand by. 8 seconds. 5 seconds, stand by. 3, 2.
This is Wright Bryan speaking from London. In the navigator's dome in the flight deck of the C-47, I rode across the English Channel with the first group of planes from Troop Carrier Command to take our fighting men into Europe. As our strong ship Snooty crossed above the breakers into the air of France, we emerged into clear moonlight. Now the paratroopers were on their feet, each adjusting his packs and snapping his ripcord over the static line.
You all set? Asked the colonel. Get this thing hooked for me, he said, as he took his own place closest to the door. The jump lights, a small bank of signal lamps, were gleaming beside the door. They blinked as the pilot threw his switch, and before I could look up, they began jumping. The Battle of Europe had begun, and our squadron had delivered the first Allied foot soldiers to their scene of action.
The name of the plane that took me to see the opening of this great invasion is Hoots Zoot Schooter. We took off before dawn, and then as the dawn of a new day spread out over occupied Europe, the marauders pointed their noses toward the east, headed for their target on the French coast. Below, as my eyes got used to the light, I counted upwards of 60 invasion boats. There were more later, hundreds. Above, the skies were filled with an infinity of planes of all descriptions. Beyond, closer to the French coast, Allied ships of war were blasting the targets along the invasion beaches. That was the picture as France loomed through the sunbeams, haze, and clouds.
My ringside seat was the heaving deck of a United States Naval Patrol torpedo boat, on which I traveled across the channel with the first contingent of a naval task force. We left our patrol torpedo boat based in daylight to accompany the slow-moving light advance guard of ships, which had to pave the way for the actual landing. Long lines of ships of every description were discernible on the skyline. Huge transports, tank landing ships, smaller troop landing craft, tankers and supply vessels of every kind plodded doggedly along under lowering skies and laboring over heavy seas. Then the fast and heavy combat ships moved up into position. All aligned themselves in the bombardment area to loose a hail of high explosives to protect the troops moving into the beaches on their landing craft. It was within only a few minutes of H hour of the long-awaited D-Day. The whole thing started moving when one man pressed a theoretical button some hours ago. That man was the Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who thinks of himself modestly as a Kansas farmer. Everything that could humanly be done had been done up to the point when General Ike pushed the button. The campaign thus passed to the direction of God and the hands of the common soldier.
As H.R. D-Day approaches, there is nothing more tactically useless than a supreme commander, except as an inspiration.
General Ike is certainly that.
One British battalion cheered him as they clanked aboard their fast landing barge. He waved a friendly hello, and that broad grin lit up his face, a face that showed nothing but confidence in his men, a face in which fatigue is miraculously erased whenever it mirrors the allied esprit de corps and the fighting spirit of the little men with rifle and bayonet. He came back from the port full of a sense of victory. No finer force ever went into battle with a better spirit or with greater courage than this one that General Eisenhower had.
For 6 hours, we have been going on here without interruption. Some of us have made 20 and 30 broadcasts to you already. We're going to continue to give you that coverage without any interruption, without any commercial announcements, without anything but perhaps a little music later in the day occasionally, but nothing but news.
Good morning, everybody. Let me summarize for you some of the various broadcasts that many of you may have been listening to for the last 3 hours. Taking everything into account, it is evident to us here in the NBC newsroom that the first phase of the invasion has been carried through successfully.
Ladies and gentlemen, as part of the NBC network's worldwide coverage of the invasion, we have brought you H.V. Kaltenborn, Dean of American News Analysts, speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York. We are preparing to bring you our own NBC newsmen reporting from the sources of this invasion story. You will hear their up-to-the-minute accounts from Washington, Britain, and elsewhere. Stay dialed to NBC for these latest details and for each development of this invasion operation.
We have yet to see a German plane over the amphibious convoy, which doesn't necessarily mean that we shan't see them before the attack is over. Our air support has been fine, and the loudspeakers call out almost constantly Spitfires on the port, or Mustangs overhead, or B-17s passing on the starboard side. And as far as I know, no report has come in of attack by a Nazi sea craft onto the convoy. Now it's almost black dark, and you see the ships lying in all directions just like black shadows on the gray sky, some signaling out to sea, sheltered on the inside from the Germans' eyes, signaling with red lights, blinking code. There are four fires on the shore, looking like pinpoints, winking, smudged by smoke. Now planes are going overhead. That baby was pretty low. I think I just made the statement that no German planes have been seen, and I think there was the first one we've seen so far. He came very low, just cleared our stack, and as he passed, he let go a stream of tracer that did no harm. And then just as that happened, there was a burst of fire on the coast just off of us 5 miles. I think you probably heard me. German planes have been in the sky now. The darkness is on us. And the tracers have been flying up. They seem to have withdrawn from them for the moment. But the plane that we just had come over our ship was the first Nazi we've seen so far. It took a pass at us and went on, and nothing particular happened. Our own ship has just gave its warning whistles, and now flak is coming up in the sky in streamers from the warships behind us. The sparks seem to just float up in the sky, and we're too far away to hear their explosions. Heavy firing now just behind us, and anti-aircraft bursts in the sky, and bombs bursting on the shore and along in the convoys of the German planes that are beginning their first attack on the night of June 6th. Now the darkness has come on it. These planes you hear overhead now are the motors of the Nazis coming and going in the cloudy sky. The reverberation of bombs. Every once in a while you see a burst of fire from a bigger caliber on one of the warships firing up.
Black hole hit.
That was a bomb hit. Another one. And the tracer lines keep arcing up into the darkness. Very heavy fire now off our stern from warships in that area. Fiery bursts. And the flak and steamer is going out in a diagonal slant. It's right over our heads. And bursting over our heads to the ship, from the ship to the side of it. Now it's died down. Blue-white flak right over our head. And we can't see the plane, nothing but the black burst of the ACAC in the dark sky. Here comes the planes. More anti-aircraft fire inboard toward the shore. And the Germans must be attacking low with their planes off our stern because the streamer fire, the tracers, is almost parallel with the water. Hot tracer lines are coming up almost all around us, off the stern and off the side toward the French coast. Flares are coming down now. You can hear the machine gunning. The whole sea side is covered with tracer fire. Going up, the beating of the bombs, the machine gunning, as the planes come over closer. Fiery low, switching smoke, brilliant fire down low toward the French coast, a couple of miles. I don't know whether it's on the shore or is the ship on fire. Here's very heavy ACAC now, right? From the naval warships, as well as 20mm and 40mm tracer, with the sounds you just heard, perhaps the burst or two of the bombs. Well, it's passed for a moment now. There's nothing but black cloud puffs from the explosions in the sky and the distant roar of the flame motors. Now they're working toward our aft again, down there near some of the British convoys. You'll excuse me, I'll just take a deep breath for a moment and stop speaking. Now, the air attack has seemed to have died down, except for the British convoy off a couple of miles beyond it. And for that one fire burning near the shore, the French shore, which is beginning to die down somewhat. Can't report that there were any hits, because there seem to have been none on any of the ships around us at all. Can see nothing in the night, no fires, or anything of that kind.
Here we go again, another plane's come over. Right over our port side. Faces are making an arc right over our bow now. And disappearing into the clouds before they burst. Faces are still going up. And now the plane is probably gone beyond. Looks like we're going to have a night tonight.
Get a pair of eyes. Another one coming over.
And a cruiser right alongside of it. Far enough. Something burning is falling down through the sky and circling down. Maybe a hit plane. They got one.
They got one.
They got that one. They got it right here.
They did, we?
Yeah. What
did you learn? Great blotch of fire came down in the smoldering now, just off our port side in the sea. Smoke and flame there. You said it.
I get the paint this back. I'll make it look like it.
We've had a few minutes pause.
The lights of that burning Nazi plane are just twinkling now in the sea and going out. When the tracer starts up again and there's warning of another plane coming in. It's now 10 past 12 and the German air attack seems to have died out. To recapitulate, the first plane that was over that we described at the beginning of the broadcast was a low-flying German, probably Ju-88, that was leading the flight and came on the convoy in surprise, we believe, because he drew up and only fired as he passed by. And perhaps he was as surprised as we were to see each other. And there seems to have been no damage to the amphibious force that we can discover. One bomb fell astern of this warship, 150 yards away. A string of rockets were fired at a cruiser beside us on the port side. No damage was done. And gun number 42 at our port, just beside the microphone, shot down the plane that fell into the sea off to the port side. It was Ensign William Schreiner of Houston, Texas, who's the gunnery control officer, and Seaman Thomas Spira of Baltimore, Maryland, handled the direction finder. It was our first kill for this gun, and the boys were all pretty excited about it. A twin-barreled 40-millimeter anti-aircraft piece. They're already thinking now of painting a big star on their turret. They'll be at that first thing tomorrow morning when it's daylight. Meantime, now the French coast is quieted down. There seems to be no more shelling into it, and all around us is darkness and no light or no firing. now 10 past 12. This is George Hicks speaking. I now return you to the United States.
That remarkable record to which we've been listening was made by George Hicks, radio correspondent representing the combined American networks. George Hicks was aboard a warship at sea off the French invasion coast when this air raid was made. It's the first recording of an enemy air attack on Allied warships. The recording was sent back to London, and it was played from London for us now.
We are bringing you this big story as it unfolds here in the NBC newsroom, the crossroads of the news.
Here's a bulletin just in from London. Prime Minister Churchill told the House of Commons today that an immense Allied armada of 4,000 ships with several thousand smaller craft had carried the Allied forces across the Channel for the invasion of Europe. He also said that 11,000 planes, 11,000 first-line planes, made the original assault and softened things up for the landing forces. Churchill also said that massed airborne landings had been successfully effected behind the German lines. Here's another bulletin from London. DNB, the German news agency, admitted in a broadcast just a little while ago that a German vessel had been sunk during violent fighting in the Seine estuary. Another bulletin, the Moscow radio in a Russian language broadcast, gave the Russian people news of the landing of Allied armies on the coast of France. The Russian broadcast, under a London dateline, reported the first communique from General Eisenhower's headquarters without comment. Here's a bulletin from Supreme Headquarters. German destroyers and German E-boats are rushing into the operational area off the north coast of France. That is the area where we're attacking. And the bulletin adds, no doubt those forces, the destroyers and E-boats of the Germans, are being dealt with by the Allies. German broadcasts said a furious battle between E-boats and Allied warships is raging off Le Havre. As the morning passed, observers on the England coast reported furious aerial activity. Bombers and fighters, that is Allied bombers and fighters, of course, are crisscrossing the coast without a halt. There's sunshine in the Dover Strait right now, but the outlook is unsettled. There was a little shower about dawn, and then banks of heavy clouds started sweeping in from the northwest about mid-morning. The wind blew fairly strongly at night, but it lost some of its strength at dawn. There was a moderate sea. Visibility was good and improving. The temperature was around the 60s. Now, that may not seem very important, but the lives of tens of thousands of Allied soldiers depend on that weather. Here's a bulletin from the Italian theater. French troops have captured Tivoli on the Avezzano Highway, 30 miles northeast of Rome. That announcement comes from the British Broadcasting Company. Oddly enough, the Allies learned their invasion lessons from the Germans, learned how not to conduct an invasion from the lessons of the Battle of Britain. Here's the story, because now, at last, it can be told. Actually, the invasion of Fortress Europa is the result of exactly 4 years of careful, very methodical planning. Into it have gone the best that free men can give, all their thought, all their ingenuity, their inventive genius. Yes, 4 years of planning have gone into this very moment when our men are fighting their way up the beaches of Nazi Europe. Hardly had Britain's army in France been snatched from the smoldering beaches at Dunkirk than plans for this moment were being laid. And we learned the lesson of invasion from the even blacker, even more bitter days that were to follow, the days of the Battle of Britain, when the hopes of free men clung by what proved to be a mighty stout thread after all, the thread of British courage. After the capitulation of Belgium and the Nazi breakthrough in France, Britain faced one of her darkest hours at Dunkirk. But darker days were still to come. For a long and aching period that seemed to spell the end of Britain, the tight little island had to content itself with defense, and defense alone. She knew that her troubles were far from over. She knew that the great test still was to be faced, and it came. It came in August and September of 1940, the great blitz on Britain. But the courageous few, the Royal Air Force, fought off the Nazi hordes and put the first big dent in Marshal Goering's arrogant German Air Force. And then the tide was turned. But stories that trickled out months, even years afterward, revealed how close Britain had come to oblivion, except for the RAF fighters. Those stories told how hundreds of German invasion barges had been caught and sunk by the RAF. Officially, both Britain and Germany kept silent, but it was obvious that Hitler had intended to invade the island empire. It was a hastily prepared invasion, and the hastily prepared plan failed. From it, the Allies learned their lesson. This failure of Hitler served as a warning that any spur-of-the-moment thrust at the continent was doomed to failure. That was the lesson we learned from the Nazis, the lesson that care, planning, caution had to be exercised if we were to succeed in smashing what the German geopoliticians called the heartland, Germany itself. And now, the moment is here, the time for fruition of these 4 years of planning, the H hour of D-Day, on which hangs the hopes of victory in Europe. And now here are several more bulletins. Bulletin from London. Swedish correspondents in Germany assert that the Allied invasion landings were made at 12 points along the French coast. The Swedish newsmen add that the central assault is now 10 miles inland at the base of the Cherbourg Peninsula. And the Stockholm paper Aftonbladet declares that the attack seems directed against the most heavily defended section of the French coast and is aimed directly at the French capital of Paris. And now here's a bulletin from Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force, London. General Sir Bernard L. Montgomery, Deputy Invasion Commander in charge of ground troops, has just expressed overwhelming conviction that the present attack will succeed. Here's what he says. I personally have absolute and complete confidence in the outcome. The party is in first-class shape to win the match. We are a great Allied team, a terrific Allied team. This is the integration of the British Empire and America going out to battle together. I don't think any other two nations in the world could have done it. I don't know when the war is going to end, but I don't believe the Germans can go on much longer with this business. The German soldier is terribly good, but I don't think the German general is as good as he used to be. He's been on the defensive a very long time, and I believe it must affect his mentality.
Ladies and gentlemen, as part of the NBC Network's worldwide coverage of the invasion, we have brought you Robert St. John, NBC commentator, with news from the NBC newsroom in New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.
This is the Advance Allied Command Post. American war correspondent Stanley Richardson has just returned from the second front beachhead with the first naval eyewitness of the operation. Mr. Richardson.
I've just returned from the channel approaches to the coast of France, where I was privileged to watch the opening phases of the largest scale military invasion operation in history. My ringside seat was the heaving deck of a United States Naval Patrol torpedo boat on which I traveled across the channel with the first contingent of a naval task force. This force was composed mostly of American units. From the time we left the British coast until we were within a short 2 or 3 miles of the French shore, our naval units encountered no enemy opposition whatsoever.
That, perhaps, is the outstanding fact
that I brought back with me. Altogether, my squadron of PT boats was in the channel for about 20 hours. We covered scores of square miles of rolling, choppy sea. We were patrolling and acting as escort for literally hundreds of slower-moving vessels of all descriptions. Many of them had been at sea longer than we had, but the Germans either were taken completely by surprise or just were afraid to come out and challenge us. Not a recognizable enemy plane appeared overhead. At least no bombs were dropped at or on any of the ships in our area. No low-flying fighters came over to strafe us with machine gun fire. And no enemy vessels, not even one of their vaunted E-boats, came out to the attack. The officers and men with whom I rode wondered searchingly about this. They had been keyed up for some real German opposition, both from the air and the sea. Their trigger fingers were itching for a scrap, and they were a very disappointed lot at not getting it. If the Germans weren't just too timid to come out, the only other ready explanation that could be advanced was that they were too busily engaged in coping with the Allied air attacks made on their shore establishments as a prelude to the actual landing of troops. In the area we covered, we could see hundreds of bombers and fighters shuttling back and forth, dropping their bomb loads and returning to England for more explosives to blast the enemy. And we could see the big two-engined American transport planes, also in the hundreds, returning to their bases in the United Kingdom after dropping their airborne troops in France. Yes, Jerry had a lot to keep him busy last night and early today, but as far as the naval phase of our activity was concerned, not a shot was exchanged with the enemy while I was on the scene. For that preliminary phase of the show, at any rate, it was all too incredibly easy. We left our patrol torpedo boat base in daylight to accompany the slow-moving light advance guard of ships, which had to pave the way for the actual landing. One of our missions was to protect the Allied minesweepers, which cleared a wide channel straight to the enemy shore for our troop transports and supply ships. Long lines of ships of every description were discernible on the skyline, literally miles of craft in even columns converging upon the area in the channel marked for the concentration point for the actual invasion. Huge transports, tank landing ships, smaller troop landing craft, tankers and supply vessels of every kind plodded doggedly along under lowering skies and laboring over heavy seas. You people at home would have been thrilled to the bone to have seen all these American men, American ships, and American supplies sailing calmly into the action for which they had been prepared and trained for so many months. It was estimated that there were more than 4,000 ships of all kinds in the channel for this combined operation. By nightfall, we were nearing the French coast and our watch tightened. But nothing happened. Even when a full near moon appearing fitfully from behind the clouds gave our position away clearly to any enemy who may have been lying in wait for us. Then the fast and heavy combat ships moved up into position. All aligned themselves in the bombardment area to loose a hail of high explosives to protect the troops moving into the beaches on their landing craft. The warships started laying their smoke screen preparatory to shooting their guns. It was within only a few minutes of H hour of the long-awaited D-Day. And right there was where I got the biggest disappointment of my life. We turned around and headed back at high speed for the English coast. Our PT squadron was under orders to return to base and refuel for another mission as soon as its first operation was completed. So I didn't even hear the bombardment begin. But I can tell you that if things are going as well now as they look to be going at the time I left the scene, it won't be long before our troops have a firm foothold.
One of the most interesting parts of any great story like this invasion is the way people around the world react to the first news. CBS correspondent Charles Shaw reported from London earlier this morning that he practically was town crier for the city of London, which was largely unaware in the early morning that the invasion had begun. Shaw rode through the London streets asking people what they thought of the news and found most of them hadn't heard it. But the answer of one girl when she heard the news from Shaw was typical. She said simply, "Thank God." And far removed from the thankful and hopeful spirit in Allied capitals is the only reaction so far noted from the Tokyo radio, which broadcast its first mention of the invasion in a German language piece beamed toward Europe. The Jap broadcast said, "We have just learned with deep concern of the landings by the Allies on the coast of France. We expect they will be quickly annihilated by the courageous German army." That from Tokyo. That's the way the Japanese put it. Up to now, there's been no mention of the landings to the Japanese people themselves, according to the United States government monitors of the Office of War Information. Our correspondent William J. Dunn reported from Australia that invasion reports have the right-of-way on Australian radios and in the Australian headlines, but he added that there is not much external excitement. Here in our own country, reaction from coast to coast was similar. People kept on working at overnight shifts in shipyards and other factories and went to work as usual this morning. But everyone seems to be more serious, and many stopped in their tasks long enough to offer prayers for the success of the Allied effort. Perhaps most dramatic of all was the ringing of the Liberty Bell in Philadelphia's Independence Hall. The ancient bell was struck six times as Philadelphia's Mayor Bernard Samuel read the famous inscription, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof." Well, German propagandists asserted today that despite the invasion of Western Europe, life continued normal in Berlin with no excitement, no additions, no special radio announcements. But a part of these assertions, obviously, were rather false. From the time of the first landings, a constant stream of broadcasts came from the German transmitters, many of them carrying more than an indication that Hitler's defenses along the western coast had been caught napping. The German press chief was quoted by DNB as saying the Allies opened the invasion on the order of Moscow. A DNB correspondent asserted the German people is longing for revenge because of the Allied bombings of their cities. The German news agency Transocean contended in early broadcasts that it was not certain of Allied intentions, but at 1 p.m. it said, this much has become clear by midday. These Allied landings mean this is the great invasion, and no fooling. That's the story from Germany.
In a few moments, we hope again to bring you another broadcast from Britain, probably from Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Forces. At that time, we hope to hear from several of our Columbia correspondents. We don't know exactly at what time we'll make the switch, but in a few moments, I expect that I will hear that it is time to switch to London. The warning will probably come very quickly, as you undoubtedly know if you've been with us for several hours during last night and this morning. You know how quickly the warning comes that London is ready. Meanwhile, in case you got up, let's say, a bit late and you've been filling yourself in on the invasion, you know that the German reports were the first reports, and we had two or three hours in the small hours last night before the Allied Supreme Headquarters in Britain announced that the invasion had begun, when all the news was coming from the German radio. It wasn't very much news, but it did say that the invasion had begun, and that turned out to be right. And so Elmer Davis, who, like most of us, rushed to his office in the middle of the night last night, Elmer Davis has this morning given a warning about this German radio propaganda. Mr. Davis says that despite the German accuracy in announcing the invasion before the official Allied communique came in from Supreme Headquarters in Britain, German broadcasts should not be relied on in the future. Elmer Davis said the reason the Germans made the announcement was possibly that they're trying to build up a reputation for accuracy so that they can put one over, he said, on the Allies later. And Elmer Davis asked Americans to remember that Joseph Goebbels is in business for his health and not for ours. Another brief dispatch from Supreme Headquarters just come in, just been handed me. It says, Allied Air Forces threw 11,000 aircraft of almost every type into the grand invasion of Europe today, bombing and strafing miles of Normandy's beaches and flying inland to break the enemy's communications. That's the latest detail that has come from the Supreme Headquarters of the Allied Expeditionary Force, that the Air Forces threw 11,000 aircraft of almost every type into the battle. And now, ladies and gentlemen, we're informed that we can hear from General de Gaulle in London. So we switch you now to London for the address by General de Gaulle.
Gagné, chacune de nos victoires, c'est ainsi que nous gagnerons celle-là. En bon ordre, pour nos armées de terre, de mer, de l'air, il n'y a point là de problème. Jamais elles ne furent plus ardentes, plus habiles, plus disciplinées. L'Afrique, l'Italie, l'océan et le ciel ont vu leur force et leur gloire renaissante. La terre natale les verra demain pour la nation qui se bat.
General de Gaulle says that never have France's forces of the air, sea, and land had such a glorious opportunity to distinguish themselves. And he speaks of the glories which the French armies have just achieved in the Italian campaign.
Soit exactement suivi. La seconde est que l'action menée par nous sur les arrières de l'ennemi soit conjuguée aussi étroitement que possible avec celle que mène de France
General de Gaulle says that the first order which he has to, which the French government has to give to the French forces, will be followed exactly.
Que l'action des forces de la résistance doit durer pour aller sans plision jusqu'au moment de la déroute allemande. La troisième condition est que tous ceux qui sont capables d'agir, soit par les armes, soit par les destructions, soit par le renseignement.
General de Gaulle says that the action which the French armies will carry out with the Allies against the enemy will be exactly conjugated with those of the Allies.
Ou à la déportation, quelles que soient les difficultés, tout vaut mieux.
And with these actions, that of French resistance will also be combined.
La bataille de France a commencé. Il n'y a plus dans la nation, dans l'Empire, dans les armées, qu'une seule et même volonté, qu'une seule et même espérance, derrière le nuage.
And General de Gaulle says that it is absolutely necessary that all French patriots capable to act by arms and by refusing to work for the Germans should not allow themselves to be taken prisoner.
Il vous est parvenu de Londres. Nous vous retournons au studio de la Voix de l'Amérique à New York.
And General de Gaulle said in concluding that the Battle of France has begun and there is no longer except a single sole will to conquer on the part of the French nation.
You have just heard a speech by General Charles de Gaulle and its translation, a running translation of that speech by Beverly Thurman of Columbia's shortwave news staff. General de Gaulle spoke to you from London.
And now here are some bulletins which have just come in while you have been listening to John W. Vandercook. London hears from Stockholm that Adolf Hitler is expected to make a speech very soon from somewhere in the West as personal commander of anti-invasion operations. And here's another bulletin from London which says that Berlin Radio tonight declares that about 15 Allied cruisers and 50 or 60 Allied destroyers are standing by in the English Channel just off Le Havre, apparently awaiting orders to hit the coast. And the German DNB news agency reports tonight that Marshal Karl von Rundstedt and Marshal Erwin Rommel, the Nazi commanders in Western Europe, are now on the spot of developments. I suppose that means they're at the front. We have a story from London tonight about Nazi propaganda. Here is what the Nazi line has been today. Today, Nazi propaganda harped on the theme that the Germans are glad the final test has come in the West and that they're confident of the outcome. Nazi radio commentators and Dr. Paul Goebbels himself acknowledged that this attack is no mere sham and that the real test in France has finally come. The German propaganda minister spoke at a National Socialist Party meeting in a town which was very recently very heavily raided by Allied flyers. And he blustered this way. The enemy believes the situation in Germany to be the same as in 1918, but the enemy is mistaken. The ears of the Germans are shut against enemy propaganda and enemy slogans. The nerve campaign recently launched by the enemy in connection with the question of the invasion likewise failed to impress the German people. We are ready to receive the enemy. A speaker for Transocean News, a Nazi propaganda agency, reported that life remains quite normal in Berlin and that there's no excitement, no extra editions of the newspapers, no special radio announcements. Well, if you were up during the night and listened to us between 12:30 and 3:30 a.m. today, you know how untrue that is. You know about all the special bulletins which we put on the air from here, from Berlin, bulletins about the invasion. Dr. Goebbels unleashed today a long-prepared assortment of anti-invasion propaganda on the French. Its theme was, "Don't help the Allies. You will be sorry when your country is handed over to the Bolsheviks by the Allies." For German consumption, Goebbels said, "The German nation is listening to one single command, and this is the great Führer's command. Under his command, we have overcome even the most serious crisis."
This is Morgan Beatty in our nation's capital. Now it can be told. The approximate date for the second front, the front that Joseph Stalin had wanted, was set in Tehran last December. President Roosevelt told us newsmen today as much of the story behind the story of invasion as he could. The second front was to come in late May or early June, in the very first days of June at the latest. The weather played the most important role in setting D-Day. The English Channel, you know, is rough, too rough for landing craft until late in May. Mr. Roosevelt said the design of invasion satisfied Marshal Stalin completely. Reporters began tossing this point back at the chief executive, there in his crowded White House office this afternoon, trying, as we reporters always will, to get all the answers you people want on the receiving end of the news. Mr. Roosevelt good-naturedly said our questions were becoming improper, and we knew it, but he was all smiles and no hard feelings. What pleased him most was the fact that the Allies had gained bridgeheads with the loss of only two destroyers and one landing ship tank. Our air losses were less than 1%, and he didn't say what the beachhead losses were. The losses among the combat teams, that is, that first set foot on enemy shores. But clearly, those losses were not nearly as great as the IA command had expected or counted on. Mr. Roosevelt sat up most of last night, you know, and so he was tired today, at least sleepy. But he's sticking on to 10 o'clock tonight, Eastern wartime, to lead the nation in prayer. The prayer he's been writing for several days. The text was released in advance so that you may join him in the service if you wish. The prayer is highlighted by a request for divine aid in the struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. The president told us in that Oval Office on the ground floor of the White House today that our great danger now is overconfidence. Overconfidence can, in his opinion, impede the war effort and impede war production. The war is not over, he said. This operation isn't over. Incidentally, Admiral Ernest King of the Navy had expressed the same thought earlier today at the White House in another interview when he said that invasion was going all right so far. The Germans, obviously, as you've been given word already, are not ready to commit their service or their reserves of either air power or manpower as yet. They sacrificed bridgeheads to us to gain knowledge of our plans as they unfold. But neither is there any cause for lack of confidence in events to date. Confidence fairly radiated from every point in Washington where D-Day was planned and in part executed. But now, for a turn around the Washington scene, here is Richard Harkness to give you the feel of the Capitol on D-Day.
Well, the president's attitude of calm, almost serene confidence is characteristic of the rest of Washington this D-Day evening. Secretary of War Henry Stimson, for instance, took time out only long enough to tell us newsmen that the invasion is going nicely, and then he went back to work. Well, General George C. Marshall, the chief of staff of our invading army, did not show up at his office in the Pentagon building until 7:30 o'clock this morning. General Marshall explained reasonably that he had done his work before the invasion. Well, Mrs. Roosevelt confessed that she, too, had known the invasion date in advance. And she says this is a day which has been hanging like a sword over our heads, but in itself it isn't very important. Well, the diplomatic representatives here from our United Nations share our leaders' confidence of success. Lord Halifax, the tall, gaunt ambassador from Great Britain, says we all have complete confidence in General Eisenhower, in his deputy commanders, and complete confidence in our allied troops. The Russian ambassador, short, stocky Andrei Gromyko, adds this: what Hitler and his criminal clique have dreaded most has happened. Germany is now forced to carry on the war on two fronts. Well, Congress went about its business almost as usual this D-Day. The Senate and House began their sessions with a moment of silent prayer. A House committee heard Sewell Avery, the chairman of Montgomery Ward, attack the National Labor Relations Board and the War Labor Board for seizing his plant in Chicago. Then the House, harking back to Pearl Harbor, wants Admiral Kimmel and General Short brought up for court-martial within the next 3 months. Now, there are some officials here this invasion day still worried about the strike outlook. This D-Day finds some 14,000 workers still idle. The most important strike, perhaps, is the walkout in the Wright Aeronautical Plant at Lockland, Ohio. Well, that is the picture of Washington on this June 6th D-Day. Our war leaders calm and confident. The people in the Capitol unexcited. And the Capitol spirit best described by President Roosevelt's decision to lead the nation in prayer by radio at 10 o'clock this evening. I return you now to Robert St. John in the NBC newsroom in New York.
The wildest invasion celebrations in all the world today were probably those which took part in far-off China, removed by so many thousands of miles from the scene of the operations. The Chinese celebrated so enthusiastically because they figured that this means that the war in Europe will soon be over, and then British American forces can turn to the east and help finish off the Japanese. The people in Tokyo got news of the invasion from their own radio, but only the Berlin version of what was happening. In Russia, there were many happy, excited celebrations. And here's a bulletin. Supreme Headquarters says that well over 1,000 troop-carrying planes took part in the airborne phase of the invasion, and that the battleship Nevada is in action in the channel, along with the cruisers Augusta and Tuscaloosa. I am sorry that we weren't able to get Rome and Moscow for you tonight, but that is the news of the world. We'll be back with you at frequent intervals, but now this is Robert St. John saying goodbye.
The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated stations will bring you all the news of the invasion as rapidly as it is received. Ever since the first news of the invasion was received shortly after midnight and continuing throughout the early hours of the morning, most of the stations affiliated with the National Broadcasting Company have been bringing you news and commentary on the greatest invasion in the history of warfare. These stations will continue to serve you throughout the night, so long as events warrant continuous broadcasting. This is the National Broadcasting Company.